they're probably, it looks like it's probably riveted together, honestly, so it's definitely not made for the average consumer to fix, but yeah, I mean, it's a shame we live in such a throwaway society now. I don't know about you, but whenever something breaks, I always try to fix it. And I know one thing that's going well with that is the RC plane community. I fly RC whenever I can. And basically for every single plane there is, there are a lot of replacement parts, and it's definitely made to optimize the longevity that you can get with it, so, yeah, okay.
Yeah, it depends upon the manufacturer and what kind of customer base they're dealing with. Some companies stockpile their parts and some don't. And sometimes, especially what we mentioned earlier, mom and pop type of stores, there are mom and pop manufacturers too. There are guys who build their stuff in their basement and they ship it to individuals, and they're very helpful. If you have a problem, they get back to you real soon. But like I mentioned before, the average age of an amateur radio operator is about 60 so it's not unusual for these mom-and-pop manufacturers to pass away or retire. And sometimes they get bought up by MSJ, but sometimes they don't. And then there's no place to get anything anymore. It all just disappears overnight. So, you know, it depends what you buy. Some people really like the disposable economy, especially if you're a manufacturer. You get to sell a lot more things that way. And if you're a retailer, you get to sell more things. And a lot of customers like it because they feel that a new shiny thing that has a blue light instead of a green light or a red light is a much better thing. So each to their own, as long as the economy can keep up the pace. That's the only problem I see with this.
Yeah, I mean, it might not be the best, but I mean, it's getting the producer's money, which is I mean, it's good for them, not especially good for us and our planet. So yeah, I mean, I have a receiver over here. I think it uses like an Arduino nano controller or whatever it's called. And I remember the rotary encoder on it seized up a few months ago. And I had to basically disassemble the whole thing. It wasn't really that difficult, but I mean, a lot of people would just probably throw it away and get a new one. But when I looked in, I could see that the quality was good as you'd expect it. I remember there was, I think it's for the screen, there was just one wire soldered to a pin for it that was being used as ground, which it was already grounded, you didn't even need it. So yeah, it was definitely not built for that. And but I mean, it works now, so over to you, net control.
AC2GS. Yeah, it depends on a lot of different factors and on your patience and expertise. A good friend of the technical net, Andy, WA2CDL, a few months before he passed away, he gave himself a job of basically rebuilding a humongous wafer switch. If you've ever seen, some wafer switches have, you know, can have 5-10 layers and a whole different, 10 different positions with each of the wafers, and he disassembled it and found little bits of bakelite to reproduce it, and it took a great deal of patience. Most people wouldn't have the patience. They would just kind of fudge it and build a different type of switch that served the same purpose but didn't look as authentic. So, you know, there are some things you could drop in, but again, a lot of times these things don't exist anymore. So you either have to rebuild them or fudge them. issue.
Yeah, I mean, I know a good example of that was, again, dating back to my CB radio. There were, when I found it in my basement a few years ago, it was like missing a battery for the microphone, I believe. And I still need to order that. But they don't really make it. There was no information on it at all. Because I believe it's an aftermarket mic, and that, and the label had fell off for it, so I had to, do a couple of days worth of research to find it, but I eventually did. It's a lot more difficult than I wanted it to be, so I really wish, that, companies could archive it a little bit better. I know that probably might not be the easiest, but, I mean, it'd be nice for them to be able to. I mean, obviously now, manuals are much easier to find and such, but, they're not as comprehensive as they were. They might just have, at most, like, general specifications, because there was a Radio Shack ham radio that I had that was released in the 90s or early 2000s, and, they had, like, an entire, like, how to take it apart, how to put it back together. You wouldn't really see that for any sort of modern anything, really. So, yeah. Over to you, KC1TMC.
Well, you know, you have to understand it's a different world. This present world, they believe in the concept of there are no consumer repairs capable of these models. So you avoid the warranty if you break the seal, and if you try and fix it yourself, you're in it by yourself and such. You know, earlier on they were more instructive or somewhat altruistically helpful, although, again, talking to old-time repair people, a lot of companies did not bother to publish modified schematics. Very often they would change little bits and pieces of the design over the years and never really document it anywhere. So occasionally repair people would pop open a chassis, look at the schematic that was provided, and not have the faintest clue what the hell was going on. So even back in the old days when they tended to be a little bit more nice about helping people fix their own equipment, they got lazy as well. And they made errors also. So you could never 100% rely on the manufacturer's schematics and such.
PhD.
This is freezing in Roy. I have to get up early tomorrow morning.
Okay, we'll wrap this up and go to you, Ed. So I assume we kind of trumbled this this subject back, forth, and sideways, Rich, correct?
Very correct.
Okay, very good. So, Ed, what's your question tonight?
Thank you, Ed, K2GJE. I really have two questions. One is about a laptop, if you could overcharge the battery. I download some data to a laptop, and when I see that the battery is fully charged, I disconnect it from its charger. But I do at times see the battery getting warm. Are these things intelligent enough so that they cannot overcharge the battery over?
Well, I think we tripled there. Someone wanted to try to take the answer? Yeah, sure.
Yeah, KC2SV2, do I have it?
Yep, you got it. Yeah, John, the repeater is yours.
I've been having a little trouble with the note here, so hopefully you guys are hearing me okay. But I can tell you that I've read a little extensively about lithium ion batteries. And two real failure modes for a lithium ion battery are sitting at 100% or falling below the minimum charge per cell. Now, what does that mean? Well, 100% is a little bit arbitrary based on the manufacturer, what they decide is 100%. Of course, they want to get life and performance out of the battery, so they choose a number that doesn't really kill the battery too quickly, but will give it some life and some hours of use every time you charge it, right? The minimum charge thing is a problem because if you go too low, in voltage per cell, one of those cells could not come back, and sometimes they even go to a negative polarity state. So let me answer your question. I'll let it up for 1 second, and then I'll go on. So if one of the failure modes is sitting at 100% all the time, the last thing you want to do is leave your laptop or other device just plugged in all the time, just sitting there, maximum all the time. I try to manage it a little where I unplug it when I'm not using it. Sometimes I'll run it down. Sometimes if I know I'm going to stop using it in 15 minutes, I'll unplug it and let it run down, you know, to somewhere a little lower. That way it's not sitting at that maximum charge. Now, many modern manufacturers of equipment that are getting on board with being smarter about this give you the option. Modern Samsung phones and Teslas, for example, give you the option to charge to some lower state. I think it's 80% for the Teslas, 85% for a Samsung smartphone. You can choose to never go over 85%. Unfortunately, I'll give you the option is to a one-time, hey, let's go to 100 this time, but Tesla does. You can say, hey, tonight, why don't you charge to 100% because I know I'm going to do a long drive tomorrow. This helps extend the life of the battery. Unfortunately, laptops don't do this. They try to do some smart things, but they don't give you the option to say, hey, look, I'm the type of guy who mostly sits on the charger. Why don't you just keep my battery right around 80%? Unfortunately, again, that is not something that I've ever seen on any modern laptop. Back to net, KC2SHO.
VHT. Yes, Jim?
I would be remiss trying to technically answer this, but I can give a real-world experience. Just a couple months ago, I had a laptop blow up in my lap, literally. And first, second, and third degree burns to my legs. I was wearing shorts at the time. And I probably wasn't using some smart battery management technologies. And I think it should be part of the scheme that you can choose to do an 80% charge. Probably mitigated a lot of the hazards, but it's real, it happens. Back to that.
Okay, Jim. For the sake of adding to this, my Lenovo laptop is able to charge something like 80%. My iPhone is has an option where it won't top it off. It'll stop long before the 100%. It depends on the manufacturer. It depends on the smart power chip. Everything today has some kind of smart power chip. The problem is that some are smarter than others, and some think that they're smarter than others. Usually, if you keep things charging all the time, even with a smart chip, it's supposed to kind of cut it off, but I think it tends to still kind of trickle occasionally, and that extra energy gets dissipated as heat. You can't really go beyond a certain point with a battery's charge capacity. It's kind of locked down by the chemical reaction nature of it, but it will take that energy and transfer it into thermal waste heat, and heat will kill a battery over time. So the more times you charge it, the more times you charge it up to 100%, the more you're decreasing its life expectancy. And, you know, if you just kind of put it out in the middle of the Saudi Arabian desert, the heat generally is going to accelerate the death of the battery. So if there's any kind of way that you can limit the charge, or you can take the battery out and just plug it into the wall unit, some laptops let you use directly the power supply and it doesn't go to charging the battery, then you'll have a longer life expectancy for the battery. You should never discharge the battery completely. There's no such thing as memory effect on lithium ions like there used to be for nickel cadmium, so you never want to discharge the battery. And theoretically, manufacturers try to ship lithium ion batteries at about 60% to 70% charge. They've settled upon that. There's not a lot of good literature on that, but the idea is that it's a good midway point where it doesn't accelerate the aging, but it doesn't lead to full discharge of the cells.
KC1CMC. I know another problem with lithium batteries in general is that whenever you have them really charged or really discharged, they can cause the electrolytes inside to undergo a reaction and turn into gas. I believe it's carbon monoxide and hydrogen, which it still stays inside of the battery compartment, but it can cause it to swell over time, which is it's not good for the battery to get to that point. I remember I had it happen to an RC battery that I had a while ago, because I left it in my plane for a extended period of time accidentally, which was not a good thing. So you definitely do not want that to happen, because it makes it more flammable than it usually is. Over the next KC1CMC.
Yes, indeed. That is certainly a thing. It is fortunately a lot more common than it exploding into flames. Usually you see that occasionally with a Tesla, with Chinese electric vehicles, especially cheap Chinese electric bikes and the chargers. I've had that happen repeatedly. I have had a Microsoft laptop come undone because the battery expanded due to that, and I've had more than a few iPhones expand on me. Amusingly, I guess, it made life a little bit easier for me to replace the battery, because one of the pain-in-the-ass things you have to do with an iPhone is pull apart the glued-together shells, and the force of the expanding battery overcame the glue. So it was very easy for me to separate the shells, unplug the old expanded battery, replace it with a new battery, and then reseal everything. So there's a silver lining to that cloud. But, yeah, that comes from just keeping it on the charger all the time, unfortunately, and assuming that the smart charger is smarter than it is.
Yeah, also one thing I forgot to mention is that usually most phones and laptops, they do have some sort of overcurrent protection to stop the batteries from exploding to some point. It's not always foolproof, but they definitely put some effort into it. And what you said about the phones being glued together, this just shows you again how they don't really go to add screws to it. That small extra step that makes it so much easier to repair. KC1CMC.
Well, yeah, I mean, generally manufacturers are not interested in you repairing their stuff. They're very interested in them repairing your stuff and charging you for it, but not the other way around. And they use as an excuse that they would need to put additional hardware to hold it down, like screws that would add to the, would break the sleek lines of the design. Nevertheless, the European Union, along with the passing a rule that cell phones have to have USB 3 connectors, none of this lightning stuff, have also issued rules that they have to have replaceable batteries. So most likely next year's iPhones and all the other cell phones in the future will not be glued together. We'll have some means to replace the batteries without yanking on it repeatedly and trying to warm up the glue and such. So things should get better as far as battery replacements. And with the first thing I've noticed with my iPhones, the first thing that goes is invariably the batteries. They have a very finite life expectancy. So the idea that it will be far easier to swap out and put in yet another battery, even though they will not allow you to upgrade the operating system for old chips and such, at least you'll have a functional old cell phone instead of a paperweight.
PhD.
Yeah.
Thanks, Roy. This is Jim, KD2VHD. It's an interesting cross the what do they call it, generations thing that's happening that folks here might not be aware of. But the youths have been pushing a concept called right of repair, and been pushing back on these companies that sell equipment that you can't fix. And or they won't let you fix, or they won't. It's a complex thing that crosses hardware, software, licensing, and product marketing stuff. And it's interesting. The youths aren't as dumb as sometimes we think they are. They're pushing back about some of this stuff about being able to fix your stuff. I don't know if you're aware of that. Back to Roy.
Yeah, Jim. There's a YouTuber called Lewis Rossman that Rich W2BZ is very familiar with. He was one of the loudest voices. He used to work in Manhattan, and he moved, I think, to Texas. And he's still yelling and screaming about it. It's gaining some traction. There are wins and there are losses. Apple is one of the worst examples where they actually bond components to each other software so that, you know, if you replace it with a legitimate copy of a component, since it's not bonded with that unique identifier, it doesn't boot up completely. I forget exactly which components do that. I think it was the camera was bonded to the motherboard. So, and there are a lot of companies like that. Again, they would rather you either buy a completely new unit or go to them where they mark up the price, and instead of replacing a single discrete component, they sell you an entire board as a replacement. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see how much traction the right to repair gets.
I'm heartened that there's somebody pushing for it, or somebody's pushing for it, from another generation other than ours. It's a hopeful sign, I think.
Well, you know, they could use saving the money as well. I mean, they're in some difficult problems. They're usually stuck with a lot of student loans, and it's very difficult to get a space on the step ladder of success. So, you know, they're looking to save a buck probably more than we are.
Yeah, I mean,
back in the right spot, though.
I know, for example,
a
good reference to this is, I believe Apple, for their MacBooks, they to change the screens and a couple other. I think there's a battery too. You had to get some tools from Apple to even do it, or else they would. They would brick your computer, and they had the audacity to charge over $100 to just rent the materials or the tools to change it. And obviously, that's not even. I mean, you could also probably go to like somebody who would do. You could probably go to someone who would do it for you, but I mean, what's the fun in that? So, yeah, I mean, I feel like tech companies especially really need to fix this. And because really we don't have any other choice other than these big conglomerates to buy from. So at least make it a pleasing experience. KC1KMC.
Well, I agree with your sentiment that that's unfortunately not how most business works. They don't really, they think of the customer when they're trying to sell you the product. When it comes to cost, they think of the stockholder. And the stockholder thinks of wanting to have his stock worth more and more and more. So how high is up? All the way to the stars, unfortunately. So even the most pleasant, amiable companies have a tendency, especially when they're very valuable and they're making a lot of money, to try and double that. So that's human nature, unfortunately. You have to complain to the engineers who built us this way.
Yeah, and I mean, of course, after all, it comes back to money, it's not about the customer. It's just about getting money, and they already have plenty of it, so it's definitely not that fair. Obviously the customers are still going to buy it, but I know the iPhone 15, which came out recently, I think that, as you said, has the USB-C, and it might have a replaceable battery, although I'm not sure about it. But the quality of it was not very good. It was very breakable, even though they marketed it as being tight. Oh, I think my transmitter is kind of fucking out here, but glitching out there, but. They're marketing it as being durable, and it really wasn't. Even though it was made out of titanium, the glass broke easily. The screen was not, and the screen was not up to par. So over to you.
Yeah, well, one second. I just want to respond. Jeff recognized, by the way. Caveat emptor. Life isn't fair, and don't trust anyone. I was born and bred in Brooklyn, and if there's one thing I learned here, it's sort of that. Let me get to Ed first, because he's kind of running out of minutes for tonight. He has to leave soon, and I'll get right back to you, Jeff. So, Ed?
K2GJ, thank you so much. I think I'm going to stay with disconnecting the charger from the laptop. On a power, is there any advantage to turning the power supply off? It shut down, of course, from the screen. But after that, I don't know if the dime battery is even being charged that maintains the clock and things like that. Is it advantageous to turn the power supply off? Over.
Well, it sort of depends on how it's working. If it's doing charging, then you're stuck with the same problem. If it's just the power supply, if you're really concerned, it's probably best to unplug the power supply. For the most part, it probably doesn't do anything if your computer is off. But again, is a computer ever really off these days? Is it possible that it's doing some chip intelligent smart charging technology? Perhaps. So if you want a belt and suspenders type of attitude for it, I would suggest you just unplug it when you don't need it.
Simple enough. Thank you so much. Have a good night.
You're welcome, Ed. Thank you for participating tonight. Be well, and we'll talk again down the line. Jeff, you wanted to say something?
ACTGSA, C2PL. Great, Matt, tonight. Thank you very much for taking my question. Actually, it's different from the ones you addressed over email. I won't bring those up because they're out of context now, but thank you very much. And all the listeners, Roy is very responsive by email. So if you think of a question in between sessions, you can just pop one off to him. Anyway, this question is has to do with the batteries. And it's not exactly the same as what we're talking about because these were alkali batteries. And I pulled down a device off the wall that needed batteries changed, and I looked inside it, pulled out four C-type batteries, 1.5-volt C batteries, and they're all in series. And, of course, like I do each time, I check the voltage on all of them. And one of them, I couldn't find my little DVM, so I grabbed a little analog meter that I had sitting here, and the needle, of course, went backwards on one of them. And, you know, most of them were at 0.8 volts, and I threw them away. The one that went backwards was the one that intrigued me. It was actually greater than 1 volt negative. The whole battery was polarized negative. I just wonder if you wanted to address that weird phenomenon of batteries in series dying eventually and one of them going negative polarity QSO.
Okay, we can address it, but we have a few people before you. Are you stuck for time?
Oh, negative. I'm happy to listen.
Okay, so we'll get back to you. I'll put you on the list, and we'll get to you soon, hopefully. Although we have a real interesting conversation coming up, right now, that I'm sure you're going to find. If it doesn't give you too much of a headache, it'll find you'll be very interested in it, I'm sure.
Okay, C1TMC. I do have to say 7-3 for now. It was nice talking to you all, and I wish you a good week.
Likewise. What's your first name?
It's Peter, over from Norwalk, Connecticut.
Okay, very good. Glad to talk to you, Peter. You know where we are every Sunday night at 8 p.m., and you're always welcome.
Thank you, and 7-3 to all.
Okay, 73. John from Los Alamos. Do you want to kind of frame this this topic at the top?
Yeah, well, I can do that. Let me finalize the previous conversation by saying, I don't know if you know, I do hundreds of cell phone, laptop, tablet repairs here every year, so it's kind of one of my little things I do to support the hobby. So they're intimately involved in that type of equipment. Anyway, changing gears, so stand by 1 second. Let me unkey. A couple of months ago, I went to an interesting talk here, a public talk, about some devices called light slingers, is the term they're using to describe these antennas, and they call it a unique type of directional broadband antenna. I think I'm just going to frame it lightly, and I think Roy has maybe read and hopefully understands it better than I do. So maybe he can give a better overview of how these things work, but they call it trying to find faster than light polarization current antenna. It's not obviously clear exactly how that works. There's something going on here at a level that probably most hams, unless you play in this field, would not understand right off the bat. And I have many questions myself, so I really have a very narrow understanding of how these things work. So, Roy, I guess if you want to pick it up and tell us what you read and what you think, back over to you, EC2GS from KC2SHO.
Okay, very good, John. This is AC2GS. The first thing I want to kind of get out of the way, because I think it's the, one of the earliest kind of blocks to any kind of useful conversation about this, is they went, for the most part, the only thing that's available that isn't on the wrong side of a paywall are publicity release discussions of the technology. So unfortunately, the real esoteric stuff I couldn't get to because it's behind a paywall. When they say it's superluminal, they mean it in terms of, and Dick, K2RIW, used to discuss this regularly. There's things called phase velocity and group velocity. The phase velocity of things can be faster than the speed of light because they do not have any inherent information in them. A sort of example of something seeming to be faster than the speed of light is if you took a laser and pointed it at one end of the moon and very quickly sweeped it to the other side of the moon. You would say that the light traveled from that one end of the moon to the other end of the moon faster than the speed of light. It wouldn't be an accurate assessment, but you could sort of say it. And there are other examples of where phase velocities can be measured at faster than the speed of light. The important thing, and the thing that the relativity keeps talking about, is actually the group velocity, which is the speed of any information transfer. So information can only be transferred at the speed of light in a vacuum and slower. Anything faster is interesting, but is devoid of information. So this device has some superluminal speed qualities to it. Let me drop for a second. The big thing to wrap your head around is our antennas were completely different. And John mentioned a VNA and impedances, and all those go out the window because our antennas use charged particles, electrons as charged particles traveling through a conductor that then produce electromagnetic waves. If you have a charged particle at rest, it has a static electric field. If you move it at a constant velocity, it has that electric field moving at that constant velocity and an induced magnetic field. If you move that charged particle at an accelerated rate, it has the magnetic field, it has the electric charge, and it also has an electromagnetic field, which is the RF that we use to talk on the radio. So it's a charged particle traveling at a changing rate. This antenna does not use electrons directly. It does not use conductors directly, which should confuse us all. What it uses is basically a glorified capacitor. It applies an electric field across a plate, and it polarizes the insulating dielectric material that's in the middle of a capacitor. The dielectric is polarizable. It has a dipole moment in it. That's what stores energy. When you put something with a higher dielectric constant between two plates, you're able to charge more because it's able to hold more charge by polarizing the dielectric material. So you're moving a charge, but it's not an electron and it's not an ion. It's a dipole of a dielectric insulator. You can then use that electric field on the plates to manipulate the charge of the dielectric material, and you can move it around. If you move around a charged dielectric, you can produce radio waves because it's another example of a charged particle. It's not an electron, it's not a proton, it's not an ion, it's a dielectric material that has a dipole moment in it. It has a negative end and a positive end, and you can orient it according to an external electric field. So this device basically uses an array of glorified capacitors, and the emissions are occurring in the dielectric insulating material between the plates of these things that ordinarily we would call capacitors. So does that sound reasonable to you, John?
Well, your explanation sure does sound easier to comprehend than what I read on the LANA webpage about it, but it doesn't mean I still fully get it, but I think I'm getting closer.
Yeah, someone said the word and then disappeared. Would you like to say more than a word? I just want a little add-on. In the bigger way, antennas of any kind need moving charges. We think of moving charges in amateur radio as electrons, as part of a current in a conductor. The guys at your place are using dielectric, and they call it different things. They call it polarity currents, which is the movement of charged dipole moments in the dielectric, but they work sort of fundamentally the same way. If you move a dielectric around, it will produce a radio wave. That person who wanted to talk, I think, try again.
K-A-2-U-C-S, you copy?
Yes, I do.
And the dipoles said to be oscillating in this instance.
Yes, yes. What you're doing effectively is applying an actual, it's not a direct electricity, it's an indirect electricity, so the electrons are feeding the plates of this thing that's really a capacitor, and they're moving the dipole moment of the dielectric material back and forth and oscillating. If it was a steady polarization, if it didn't change, it wouldn't emit anything. It needs to be a ever-changing charge in order to produce radio wave emissions.
And it has to be manipulated at a certain rate in order to generate a certain frequency.
Yes, the dielectric has to be excited at the frequency that you want to transmit. One of the extra benefits that they discuss is that by manipulating the array of capacitors, you can basically steer the beam any place you want it to go, so that, at least in their press release, you could send two different signals with using the same exact frequency, but direct the two emissions in the opposite direction of each other so that they don't interfere.
Question.
Yes, the question?
KD2VHG, it seems to me you're describing somebody figured out how to make an antenna that does not require real estate. Am I missing the point?
Among other things, that's another feature that the press release talks about, that you can make them small, you can make them big, you can make them round, you can make them square, you can make them flat. They are not standing wave antennas that most amateurs are most familiar with. So there's no such things as impedance or resonances. You can build them as small as you want, as big as you want. It can be designed for any form factor.
Go on, please.
Well, I mean, that's the gist of it. It's a completely different technology. It's in its very earliest of stages. My guess will be when it's finally rolled out, it'll be rolled out for NASA and the defense industries, and hopefully eventually reach us. One of the things that they promote heavily is that this is going to make things much easier for cell phone towers, which are technologically kind of state-of-the-art these days with 5G and such. So it should improve the ability of cell towers to efficiently do their job. If and when it descends down to the level of amateur radio operators, I have no clue, again, because I was stuck on the other end of a paywall. But it's a sort of a fascinating thing. you know, there are other ways of emitting RF. You know, there are other charged particles. Like I said, we use electrons. You can theoretically use protons. You can theoretically use ions, and they've settled on dielectric charges as the best approach for this. So it's kind of amazing to me. For the first 5 or 10 minutes, it gave me a mild headache, but it rose after I kind of wrapped my brain around it. I hope that I made it understandable for people out there, because it's not an easy concept to deal with. We're kind of used to a whole different version of electromagnetic generation.
Hey, I have more questions.
I think that, there was Jeff and there was John. Since this is John's question, yeah, you have any other question, John?
A couple of things that came to my mind, and the lady at the presentation, I think I asked her similar questions, didn't quite come to a conclusion is, you know, how do you feed these things? How do you, you know, is this something that really needs to be attached to some active electronics? You're not just going to stick one up on a pole with a piece of feed line, is my interpretation. Also, what kind of power limitations do you think they're going to have? In other words, is this limited only to the lower end of the power spectrum where, you know, for some simple communications, or are these things going to be able to handle kilowatts and megawatts? Will they revolutionize like broadcast as well, or are we only looking at a few watts? I think that that just about covers it. The AC2GS from KC2SHO.
AC2GS. Well, the way that they're presenting it on the press releases, they haven't really mentioned anything that brings high power handling capability. I think they're looking more for point-to-point contacts like cell phone towers and such. As far as I can understand it, it's a lot like just the general capacitor. What's the power rating of a capacitor? And unfortunately, the answer is it depends on the capacitor. There are capacitors that are rated for low power. There are massive capacitors, you know, depending upon voltage and currents, the breakdown of the distance between the plates supplying the polarization to the dielectric material, the nature of the dielectric material, the breakdown current for the dielectric material. You know, moving those charged particles back and forth is going to produce some percentage of waste heat. So you're going to heat up the dielectric, and if the dielectric is sensitive to temperature, you're not going to have a lot of power going through it. So depending upon the design, and mentioning how it's wired, I don't think necessarily there's a lot of complicated circuitry required other than phase orientations and the ability to change switching connections, or, you know, simple type of things like that, because it's basically applying a given alternating current to two plates of a capacitor and having the magic happen in the dielectric. You could gang them up parallelly, serially, any way that you would want to, and they probably have done a lot of studies to find out what the results of different orientations are. So this is still in the early stages. And this is the best my understanding of press releases can go.
Yeah, understood. Like you said before, we're just kind of dependent on what the press releases say for now. But I'm very curious about all these things, and interesting to see in the future. kind of makes me want to go work for that group just to learn more. But then, of course, I probably would not be able to say anything at all. So, really, thank you for your interpretation of that. I think it's very helpful. Perhaps we'll find some YouTube videos on it in the near future. I'm sure people have speculated on it already. I just haven't delved that deep into it to see what we can find. And back to you, that's all I've got. EC2, GF, thanks for your work there. KC2SHO.
Okay, welcome, John. If you're ever able to finagle around those paywalls and can make a copy for me, I would be happy to read it. Probably would give me another nosebleed or a headache, but I would still be fascinated. You know, I mean, I never really thought in terms of other charged particles moving than electrons in a conductor. But there's nothing inherently against it. Matter of fact, in one part of the press release, they say that aspects of this antenna go all the way back to Maxwell's equations, which they do, because obviously Maxwell's equations discusses dielectrics and such. Jim?
So I'm curious, does this have any more solidity, you know, legitimacy to based on, in reference to fusion reactors? Is this just, you know, antennas will no longer require any space to put up, or I don't know if you catch where I'm getting at. Sounds like a lot of wishful thinking to me.
Well, again, I mean, there are antennas out there that do not require residence. Traveling wave antennas that we've discussed in the past don't have a resonant frequency. You know, the problem is their efficiencies aren't particularly good. Now, I don't know what the efficiency of this design is, but as I mentioned, because it's happening at the level of a dielectric layer, it doesn't require to be resonant. It doesn't require a lot of things we sort of take for granted with our standing wave antennas. So it may not be wonderfully efficient. I have no information on the general efficiency of these designs, and they probably depend upon the specifics of whether they use an array of these capacitor-like devices or not. You know, and probably if you build them bigger, you can build them with more arrays that improve their efficiency. Again, on the basis of a press release, I can't really tell you what the efficiencies are. So they've been working on it, according to the press release, for 15 years. I would assume they're not going to waste their time. They're more legitimate than a lot of other players in the field. I tend to be a skeptic, too. But, you know, when it comes to this, based upon the information that they have released, it sounds like a good possibility. Again, the only limiting factor, as I see it, is the efficiency of the designs, which are yet to be described. It's very strange. The audio itself is kind of breaking up, but I can hear you, Ed. I'm sorry, Ed, but about two-thirds of that were dropped out of the repeater. So I understood the very end when you turned it over to me, but I don't have a clue what the rest of the transmission was.
Is this better, Uncle Miles?
Much better.
Did I say it again?
Echo.
I have a 40-meter dipole in my backyard and an antenna tuner on my rig, and I have no problem using the antenna tuner getting out on 20 meters, which makes it a non-resonant antenna. I believe the resonance is more about matching to the transmitter and less about launching signals into space. And while if you push that too far, you're going to have problems. But for something as simple as meat and potatoes as a 40-meter antenna on 20, I don't think there's any real problem with efficiency. Is it 100%? Is it lower? Yeah, by much. I don't think so at all. How's that better?
Yes, that is much better. I don't know there's definitely going to be a decrease in the efficiency because there's going to be a mismatch and there's going to be loss going as the signal bounces back and forth between the antenna tuner and the antenna. Also, your lobes are probably going to get a lot more complicated. It's going to shift from the standard resonant lobe to a somewhat corrected version where you'll have nodes pointed in one place, lobes pointed at another. So it might be lucky, it might be pointing in the right direction for you, but generally speaking, I don't know, but the whole idea, I thought of standing wave antennas were that they had standing waves that fed back on themselves to store up the energy so that they could be emitted by the radiating antenna.
These are separate issues. Let's take the one of directionality and pattern and coverage. I don't know about you, but when I throw out a CSU on 740 kilohertz, I don't care if a guy in Fort Lauderdale or Dubuque comes back to me. So I'm not that concerned about, I'm not that concerned about coverage. Now, if I have a shed with somebody in some particular part of the planet, I might want to get a directional antenna and point it in their direction instead of counting on a non-resonant dipole or even a resonant dipole.
Okay, but you know, when you're doing the impedance transforming, I think you're also affecting the phases of the voltage and the current on the transmission line, and so when they get to the antenna, I always got the impression, I never really saw it written down, that they effectively balance out and act like a resonant radiator.
The secret is the electrons haven't read that book and they don't know any better, so they do what they want to do.
Okay, but an alternating current is going through an LC circuit, and LC circuits do have this tendency to shift the phases between the two.
Yes, and phased array radar antennas to live and die by that.
Okay, so I'm just thinking that, again, because we do call these things standing wave antennas, so if having a resonance is kind of unnecessary, why do we still call it a standing wave antenna?
I don't know. It's too late for me to think about that.
Okay, I accept that as your answer, Ed. It's a combination of things. I think, well, everything being equal, you would still prefer, theoretically, to have a mechanically resonant antenna than to fix it at the antenna tuner. Maybe I'm incorrect in my assumption.
I said, I do just as well on 20 meters put my 40 meters dipole and antenna tuner as I do on 40 meters. You know, do I have problems? Yeah. Do I get contact? Yeah. So, I'm happy. But that doesn't mean to say that it applies everywhere. There are cases where what I am saying now does not apply. Like I said, a phased array radar